Imagine leaving your front door and instantly running this incredibly complex security program in the background of your mind.
Right.
You've got your keys securely placed between your fingers. You're mapping the closest well-lit exits.
Yeah.
You check the shadows near the parked cars, and you assess the posture and the walking speed of the person 20 feet behind you. Now imagine running that diagnostic program every single day of your life, from the moment you step outside until you are behind a locked door again.
Just constantly running.
Exactly. And then imagine having to pay for the privilege of running that program out of your own pocket. When you hear the phrase mental load, your mind probably jumps immediately to domestic responsibilities.
Like keeping track of groceries or childcare.
Right? The invisible chores of running a household.
Hmm.
But today, we are setting that definition entirely aside. The deep dive we're taking today focuses on a completely different kind of mental load, one that operates in the shadows, but is, it's infinitely more exhausting because it is fundamentally about physical and psychological survival.
And that's a really critical distinction to draw right at the beginning. The material guiding our discussion today is this in-depth training course developed by Hassell.UK. It's titled Harassment, the Mental Load.
Yeah.
And they define this specific burden as the invisible, relentless work that goes into staying safe, staying organized, and maintaining constant situational awareness.
And our mission today is to pull that invisible weight out into the light. We are going to examine the exhausting reality of safety planning that, disproportionately falls on women and marginalized groups. We really need to look at the deeply ingrained societal conditioning that puts that weight on their
Yeah,
shoulders.
absolutely.
And crucially, we're going to explore how we as a society can fundamentally stop passing this burden down to the next generation. Because before we can begin to dismantle this mental load, we first have to make it visible to those who have the privilege of not carrying it.
The difficulty in making it visible, though, is that this load has become so profoundly normalized. It operates quietly in the background of everyday life, to the point where the people carrying it often don't even consciously register the calculations they're making. It's just seen as the cost of existing in public.
Right, and that cost is extracted through thousands of tiny daily micro decisions. We aren't just talking about the obvious moments of immediate danger. We're talking about the baseline calculations a woman is forced to make just to commute to work or go to a grocery store.
Yeah.
It's the instinct to pretend to be on a phone call when walking past a group of loud men on the sidewalk, or the deliberate choice to change seats on a train because someone's proximity feels slightly off.
Or checking a friend's location sharing app until you know for a fact they made it home.
Exactly. When you look closely at those micro decisions, you realize they are fundamentally about risk mitigation. But what stands out in the training material is the sheer volume of tangible costs attached to that mitigation. It's not just some vague feeling of anxiety.
No, not at all.
There is a literal, calculable financial tax to this mental load. It means paying for a taxi or a rideshare instead of walking or taking the bus simply to avoid feeling vulnerable at a bus stop after dark.
Right.
It means sometimes turning down specific jobs or skipping late work shifts entirely because the journey home feels too risky. Women are routinely sacrificing their own economic opportunities just to guarantee their physical safety.
Which means safety is essentially being commodified. I mean, if this checklist is running constantly and has such tangible costs, why do so many people, even those carrying the load, not realize it's happening?
Well, the source material uses this really great analogy of a computer processor. It's like having dozens of heavy, demanding tabs open in the background of your web
What do
browser.
I see?
Yeah, the computer still functions. You might only be looking at one screen, engaging with one primary task, like your job or conversation, but those background tabs are quietly draining the battery to zero. The processor is working overtime just to maintain the status quo.
Wow, yeah, just a constant battery drain.
Exactly. That is what this safety checklist is. And beyond the financial cost, the emotional and mental costs are staggering. Think about the physiological reality of hypervigilance. Constantly scanning your surroundings means your nervous system is trapped in this low-level state of fight or flight.
Yeah, that's exhausting.
It is. You have the mental exhaustion of second-guessing your clothing choices before you even leave the bedroom,
Yeah.
running a calculation on how an outfit might be perceived by a stranger,
Right.
or the draining psychological process of replaying encounters in your head after the fact, asking yourself, was that comment actually harassment, or am I just overreacting?
That's just a heavy burden on its own.
And finally, we have to look at the social cost. Think of the sheer number of times a woman says no to a professional networking opportunity or a friendship or a simple night out because the logistics of staying safe feel too uncertain. Each choice might seem incredibly small in isolation, but together they form a massive gap in personal freedom. There's a powerful quote from the material that really summarizes the core injustice of this reality. It says, "Safety shouldn't be something you have to budget for."
That's a strong statement.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to budget your money or your mental bandwidth just to walk down a street.
Recognizing the sheer weight of that battery drain raises a pretty difficult question, though. I mean, who is putting it there? That exhaustion doesn't just spontaneously generate.
Right.
If we're going to dismantle the load, we have to look at the societal architecture that installs these background programs in the first place.
We really have to look directly at social conditioning. Because this mental load is taught, it's reinforced, and it is entirely normalized from a remarkably young age. If you look at how we raise children, the differences in how we speak to them about moving through the world are stark. From childhood, girls are explicitly taught to be careful. They are taught to smile when they feel uncomfortable, to say it's fine, to keep the peace when it is absolutely not fine, and to constantly manage everyone else's reactions, even the reactions of the people who are making them feel unsafe.
Well, boys are generally just taught to, what, stay out of trouble?
Exactly, or to be brave. Women are taught the mechanics of preventing harassment. Men are rarely taught the mechanics of not causing it. And that fundamental asymmetry creates a one-sided safety load where women are expected to absorb all the fear, all the planning, and all the responsibility.
And that childhood asymmetry is immediately reinforced by adult media, right? I mean, public messaging.
Oh, absolutely. You see it clearly in public safety campaigns. Even the well-meaning campaigns routinely target potential victims rather than potential perpetrators. The messaging is always directed at women. Trust your instincts, know your limits, or never leave your drink unattended.
Everywhere. And I was really struck by the media language aspect in the source material. How subtle reporting differences, like saying a woman was mugged versus a man was robbed, quietly shift the blame onto the victim.
Yes, exactly. The reporting will meticulously detail what the woman was wearing, what neighborhood she walked through, or whether she was walking alone.
Right, but a victim of a robbery is rarely interrogated about the length of their coat or why they had a wallet in their pocket.
No, never. But when it comes to violence against women, the narrative focuses almost exclusively on the victor's proximity to risk, which quietly signals that the violence was a consequence of her own miscalculation.
Yeah, displacing the blame.
And the ultimate tragedy of that displaced blame is the impossible rulebook it creates. The contradictions women are told to navigate are literally impossible to satisfy.
How so?
Well, you are told to take a taxi, so you are dropped right at your front door safely. But wait, no, you should actually take the train because there is safety in a crowded carriage.
Right, right.
You are told to wear headphones so you can ignore catcalling on the street. But actually, no, never wear headphones because you need to remain completely alert to your surroundings.
It creates a closed loop where the victim can always be found at fault no matter what choice they made.
Exactly. You're told not to answer a harasser because they'll think your response is an invitation, but you're also told you must politely reply. Otherwise, you'll injure his pride and escalate the situation. Every single piece of advice contradicts another. It places women in a perpetual no-win situation.
Yeah.
And this brings us to one of the most profound insights from the research. It says, safety tips don't keep women safe. They keep women quiet.
Wow.
Yeah. Because when a woman internalizes this contradictory rulebook, she inevitably believes that her choices control her safety. And therefore, if something happens to her, she assumes she must have made a mistake. She must have calculated wrong. That internalized self-blame is the exact mechanism that leads to silence.
That's incredibly heavy. But the source material pushes us to look deeper, right? I mean, we've established that the rule book is impossible for women in general.
Yes.
But women's safety isn't just a single shared experience.
No, it's not. We have to push deeper into the reality of intersectionality and examine how this baseline mental load is compounded for marginalized groups. Because safety does not exist in a vacuum. It intersects directly with race, with sexuality, with disability, religion, and class.
So how does this intersectionality change the actual mechanics of day-to-day safety planning compared to the baseline mental load we just discussed?
Well, the baseline rulebook assumes a very specific privilege default. When you factor in race or a visible disability, it's like navigating a dangerous maze where the walls keep shifting. You aren't just calculating how to find the exit, meaning avoiding harassment. You are simultaneously calculating how to blend in and managing how others perceive you.
Right, just in case you need to report an incident and actually want to be believed.
Exactly. For marginalized groups, the load becomes exponentially heavier. They're often facing multiple overlapping forms of harassment simultaneously. It is not just one kind of threat assessment. A Black woman may experience racialized harassment deeply intertwined with sexism. She has to run a calculation on how racial stereotypes might make bystanders less likely to step in and help her.
Yeah.
Or a Muslim woman wearing a hijab must constantly manage the ever-present threat of Islamophobic abuse alongside unwanted male attention. The text makes it clear that it doesn't just add to the calculations, it multiplies them.
Right, and the physical environment itself becomes a different kind of threat landscape, depending on your identity.
Completely. Consider a disabled woman navigating a train carriage. She has to calculate her physical environment in a way an able-bodied person never considers. If someone inappropriate sits too close to her, simply standing up and walking to another car isn't always an option. She has to constantly run the background calculation of, if a situation escalates, can I physically escape? Or look at a queer or trans woman who may face intense, targeted harassment based specifically on her identity, navigating both gender-based violence and transphobia in the exact same moment. The more identities you carry, the more calculations that algorithm runs every single second.
The emotional impact of that, the intense hypervigilance required to carry a multiplied load like that, it must be deeply isolating.
It is. It leads to profound isolation because the individual feels like even their well-meaning peers won't truly understand the specific nuance of their daily experience. And over time, carrying that multiplied load leads to resignation. It's this heartbreaking psychological acceptance of unfair, hostile treatment as simply being normal.
So having laid out the immense unequal weight of this load, the final step really has to be examining our own complicity in perpetuating it.
Yes.
How do we fundamentally change the culture?
We have to confront what the material calls the cycle of passing it on. And this is often the hardest part of the conversation because this cycle usually stems from genuine care. Think about the well-meaning advice given by parents, teachers, and friends. We say, text me when you're home, or don't walk down that alley, or make sure you cover your drink. We do this out of love. We do this to protect the people we care about.
Yeah, of course.
But in doing so, we are accidentally teaching girls that safety is entirely their job. We are quietly, efficiently teaching them that the world will not protect them, so they must manage it themselves.
It's an insidious cycle. Under the guise of care, we're basically transferring our own anxiety onto the next generation rather than actually solving the systemic problem.
Exactly. But the research offers a critical solution to breaking the cycle. It doesn't suggest that we should suddenly stop caring or stop assessing real physical risks, but it insists that we must actively pair any practical safety advice with explicit reassurance.
Like what?
Like, if we are going to teach precautions, we must simultaneously reinforce the message. If something happens to you, it is not your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. We have to make sure every be careful is matched with the firm you are not to blame. The goal has to be raising confidence, not installing a baseline of anxiety.
That makes a lot of sense.
And beyond the individual level, we have to reframe the concept of responsibility entirely. Safety has to become everyone's job. This means stepping up bystander intervention. It means advocating for the physical design of safer public spaces.
Right.
And crucially, it means fundamentally changing how we talk to boys and men about their role in this dynamic.
That really stood out to me in the source material, this specific advice for men. It asserts that most men aren't the problem, but all men can be part of the solution.
Yes.
It outlines the vital importance of men taking on the mental load of challenging sexist comments within their own private circles.
Mm.
You know, actively noticing when someone in a public space looks uncomfortable and actually taking the step to interrupt the situation or check in with the person.
And that is where we reach the absolute core truth of this entire issue. There is this really poignant phrase in the material about how we pass down safety advice, like family recipes.
Yeah.
Generation after generation, we hand down the rules of the impossible rulebook. But what we are unknowingly passing down is a legacy of fear, hypervigilance, and internalized blame. We cannot lighten the mental load for the next generation by teaching them how to carry it more efficiently. We can only lighten the load by ensuring they have to carry it less.
Right.
True safety doesn't come from a set of restrictive, contradictory rules aimed at potential victims. True safety comes from a culture that refuses to tolerate the harassment in the first place.
A culture that challenges the root causes of the violence, rather than simply forcing half the population to relentlessly manage the symptoms.
Exactly. So to summarize, the core thesis of this deep dive is that the mental load of safety is a systemic social problem. It is not a personal flaw, is not a personality trait of an anxious person, and it should never be an individual responsibility to manage the threat of harassment.
Yeah, it's an invisible weight that demands to be seen and shared.
So as we close today, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Think about that invisible safety checklist you or the people you care about run through every single day. Look closely at that list and ask yourself, what is one specific burden on that checklist that would immediately disappear if just one more person in your community stepped up to share the load?